I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
Part of who I really am is a maker of fictive objects, and I've known that for a long time. I feel much less constrained in terms of what kinds of fictive objects I can make. Hi, I'm Stephanie Burt, and this is the title poem from my collection of poetry, Advice from the Lights. If you don't get too close to people, you can't disappoint them, which would be so much worse than letting them disappoint you. To the extent that you gain a perch that means other people look up to you, to just that extent, you can never tell them how you feel. You can warble, or follow a siren, or a Shenandoah vireo into the shade, or take advice from the lights. Be a child, or be like a child. You will want for nothing, and you will never be heard.
Thank you. You read that so beautifully. I say this every time I have a poet read, but, you know, I spend all this time with the poem beforehand, and then just hear it in your own voice is so wonderful, and I really appreciate the way that you take time with it, and I loved that. It was such a great experience to hear
you
read it.
It's funny. I've rarely read that one, you know, aloud, and I'm happy with it as the title poem for that book. But it's one of the poems in that book that seems quite distant from what I'm trying to do now.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, because it reflects a sense of isolation that I no longer feel.
Oh, say more about that.
I mean, in this case, it's quite easy. Coming out as binary trans and transitioning and just like living as a woman and as a mom rather than trying to occupy cultural and visual and physical roles that hurt. Coming out and transitioning not only have made me more, you know, physically comfortable in my body, which is what everyone says happens, but they've made it much easier for me to have closer friendships, plural, closer friendships, and to be in more spaces where I felt comfortable. And some of those spaces are pedagogical and educational spaces, and some are not. But the sense of, I think, the sense of I have friends and I have loved ones and I have family, but I'm very, very much alone, that runs through all of my books of my own poetry, all the way up through Advice from the Lights, is now, I don't want to say gone, but it's been dramatically alleviated by just coming out and transitioning and making the friends that I've made directly or indirectly as a result of coming out as binary trans and transitioning. And the next books of poems, because I hope there's going to be at least two more books of poems by me, are, I think, continuous with what Advice from the Lights is doing, but I think they're going to be, I know that one of them is going to be much more about finding community and not being alone.
I'm so glad that you said what you just said, because, again, I mean, and this is something that you articulate so beautifully in each chapter of your book, Don't Read Poetry, which we will talk about. But my experience of this poem was, I thought, this seems to me to be a poem about being the isolation part seems to be right on, but it seems to me like also to be about being in the position of being a critic.
Yes, and a teacher, and it's also an experiment, that poem, as are a couple other of my poems in that book, with writing poem that feels like a fragment, that feels very kind of dry, and, you know, there's no rhyme, there's no really prominent euphony. All the structure, if there is any, is syntactic rather than acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a great deal of difficulty for a lot of my life being anything other than a teacher or a student. And those are both wonderful things to be. And I like being both of them. But you don't want to just be one or the other all the time. For some of the same reasons that if you have kids, it's great to be a mom or a dad if you're a guy, or a non-binary parental figure if that's who you are. But you don't want to have to act as a parent all of the time. And you don't want to be the only parent around if you can avoid it. Mm. You don't always want to be in a position either of setting rules or of following rules. And if that's all you're doing, that's quite isolating, no matter how good a teacher you are.
Yes. When you put it in the frame of parenthood, it makes me think, too, of like moments as a parent when I have just momentarily, for whatever reason, let my guard down with my kids and said something that was like maybe over their heads or kind of cutting humor that I wouldn't necessarily use with them, you know?
Yeah.
And the discord in the relationship, like they didn't expect that. And it's like, wait, no, it's like seeing your teacher at the grocery store. Like, no, you're the one thing to me. And I can't have you be both. Or be something different. It's really, those moments are really memorable to me.
That's right. It's quite hard to figure out because there's a sense in which you never stop being a parent, right? Even when you're not being a parent,
right.
There's a part of you, there's an antenna up that's like, are my kids okay? What are they thinking? And there's a way in which what the sociologist Irving Goffman calls front, the way you present yourself to someone else, which could be authentically part of you but is never all of you. There's a certain amount of conscious fronting that you're doing in that sense when you're being a parent, and that's good, but it's also important that your kids know that there's more to you than they're seeing.
And it's also like moments where, like, if I'm talking to my husband and we think we're having a private conversation and I'm allowing, as partners do with each other, like I'm allowing myself to be catty or bitchy or say something like really shitty about someone, and I swear to God, it's like that Galway Canal poem about I can stay up talking with any reasonably sober Irishman, but let there be the stifled come cry and the kid comes running after making love we hear footsteps. But
I have not thought about that particular poem, effective as it is, in some time, and now you've brought it to mind.
Oh, I love that poem. But it's also she will hear me say something crappy or like petty, and it's like, that's not the way,
she, your kid.
She can just pick it out, and it's like that discord where, like, if she says something petty or if she's having an emotional struggle with a friend, I'm always trying to help her find, like, well, it's good that you're taking the middle ground and you're trying to help them mediate this, where, like, if I was in the middle of that situation as an adult, I might just be like, well, yeah, well, she's, you're right and she's wrong or whatever,
It's
just interesting. And in fronting also, that notion of fronting, that is in some way, I mean, it goes back to the literary criticism, like being a literary critic or being a critic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fronting that must go on.
And
there
there's a way in which being trained and professionalized as a critic used to mean being trained to treat every list. I'm old enough that I got some of this when I was trying to learn how to do the thing that I do professionally and that also is fun for me, that I do like it or not, which is why I write books about it. I sort of can't stop. When I was trying to figure out how to be an arts critic and a poetry critic, I encountered the idea that you need to bracket all of your personal commitments, that your sort of aesthetic and properly critical response to a poem, the one you're conveying and writing when you write about a poem, needs to somehow be severed from how old you are, what your ethnic background is, whether you're into guys or into women or neither or both, how tall you are, whether you like watching hockey or not, all of those aspects of your life, including the ones you can't change that are what American law calls immutable characteristics, that you need to somehow bracket them in order to have a properly aesthetic response to a work of art. Now, I no longer believe that. I think you need to be conscious of them I am conscious of, I hope, how my own tastes and my own identity characteristics and my own identities shape my response to one poem or another. And my angle of approach to a poem about American football, a sport I do not enjoy watching, is going to be a little different from my angle of approach to a poem about basketball, which I love watching. My angle of approach to a poem about trans identity, because I'm a trans lady, is going to be different from my angle of approach to a poem about, let's say, having a physical disability, which that I don't have, or a poem about living in rural Canada where I don't live. And I try to compensate for that, to think about what a poem does as a matter of language with the experience from which it began. But I no longer try to remove from my own response the rest of me. I don't think you can do that. And I think it's important for those of us who have backgrounds that are majority backgrounds or unmarked backgrounds that affect our responses. And for me, the obvious example would be I'm a white lady, to be conscious that we have those backgrounds and you can't stop being white or stop being American when you're reading a poem or hearing a song. You can just try to establish a relation to that that is self-conscious as a critic, just as you would if you were Irish or South African or, you know, Martian.
You know, Stephanie, so listening to you talk about this is just fascinating because of the idea of Goffman, like Goffman's work and how he talks about having embodying or being in the space of backstage.
Yeah.
And like, I was just thinking about how liberating it is to not have to be on stage all the time and the freedom that you get with that backstage presence and who you can be and how you can interact with things and how that's such a breath of fresh air for everyone to inhabit that in your daily life and how exhausting it must have been to always be teacher or a student and now to have access to kind of like a backstage conversation that is just like, to me, it almost like makes me cry. I'm like, that is just such a breath of fresh air. And then you're not as or there's not like a, I don't know, sometimes when you always have to be on stage and you always have to act, you don't have access to your background in a way that you would, a way that you do when you're off stage, you know?
So I do and I don't. Thank you. I love the presentation of self in everyday life, which is the book by Irvin Goffman that we're talking about. For those of you out there in radio land who aren't familiar with mid-century sociology, it's a really good book. But I would not actually draw the same contrast that Goffman does between being on stage and being backstage for the literary purposes, although for his purposes it's useful. I feel like any interaction with anyone is to some extent playing some kind of role. One of the reasons I like poetry is that it allows a great deal of freedom in terms of thinking about who you're interacting with, what your role is in language, who you're going to be. It's as close to backstage as you can get. And it's still an interaction with an imagined reader. I don't feel like I'm suddenly not playing any roles anymore. I feel like I have more roles to play and better roles to play and better stages and more authentic scripts.
Nice, yeah.
And more ensembles and better ensembles to be in. At the same time, for you know, the two people listening who know me, my experience of coming out as a public, as a semi-public figure and a teacher and just as a person in private life has not really been an experience of giving things up. It's not as if I had, you know, broken my contract and walked out of my engagement with the music hall in Kent in order to take up new roles in Dorset. That's not how it has worked for me, although for some people that is what coming out is. It's more that I've got additional engagements and my calendar's full, but I've and the new ones are extraordinarily important to me. But I don't feel like I've had to give up a lot of social interactions. However, the people I've known for a long time and the people I've worked with for a long time can now, you know, see me in a way that is not wrong, and it feels better. Mm. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a costume change in the old roles plus new roles that are great roles, but I haven't quit the old roles. Does that help?
But do you feel that that backstage presence is more or do you feel that you have access to kind of just being as opposed to acting, or do you feel as if it's still acting, it's just a more authentic self?
That's a hard question, and I want to try to answer it without splitting metaphysical hairs. And I wouldn't have said this 2 years ago. I probably would have said this a year ago. I think I do have access to something that feels like just being, to something that feels entirely authentic. Mm-hmm. But the odd thing is that authenticity, that sense of being able to be who I am in the world, is inseparable from the creation of imaginative works. That part of who I really am is a maker of fictive objects. And I've known that for a long time. I feel much less constrained in terms of what kinds of fictive objects I can make.
Can I ask one more question now?
Now
that we've had this conversation, it was the question that I wanted to ask you to talk about. And now I want to go back to it because it's even more interesting to me now. I feel like our listeners need...
Hi, listeners. we're talking fairly abstract matters of personality and sort of queer sociology, and we're going to talk about some poems soon.
Well, I mean, I don't know. We might go back to this, but I'm so curious to hear you speak about what the lights mean in this poem.
Oh, in the title? Oh, jeez.
And in the book in general. I just want to hear you talk about it.
So this book was, Advice from the Lights, was an absolute nightmare to title. I didn't know what it was going to be called for so long. And at one point I wanted to make it into two separate books. And I'm quite grateful to Jeff Schatz, my editor at Grey Wolf, for saying, no, this is one book. You are one person. And at the time I was still trying to be non-binary, to be sort of they, them, theirs, and present as a guy here and a girl there. And it was actually really hard. And Jeff sort of saw what was coming before I did and said, no, you're one writer and this is one book. And the title is about how someone like me, empowered adult teacher, mom, person, is often giving advice and often expected to give advice. And I have real doubts about whether anyone should take it, because it's sometimes advice given from someone on stage who's in the lights to the audience, where you can see me, but I can't see you. It's also advice from the stars, from the constellations, from people who are just far away, which reflects my position of relative economic privilege and also just my ensconcement in various kinds of elites, like it or not, it's part of where I'm coming from. And they're also swamp lights, right? Like the ignis fatuus, the glowing entities that show up that are lit up marsh gas that will lead you through a swamp but won't actually lead you anywhere useful. Robert Frost, who terrifies me, speaks of himself in arguably his greatest poem as a guide who has only at his heart, you're getting lost. And I certainly hope that that is not what my own poetry, or indeed what great poetry in English that's not by Robert Frost, tries to do. But I am afraid that I am getting people lost and that I'm telling myself what I want to hear rather than what I need to hear. Those are things I'm afraid of. So I'm afraid that I'm both giving and getting advice, or giving myself and giving others advice, that comes only from these false lights or these distant sources of illumination, and shouldn't be followed.
That's so fascinating. And then makes me want to then ask about that last line, right? You can, or that last stanza starts, you can warble or follow a siren or a Shenandoah. Is it a vireo?
Vireo, yeah. Vireo. It's a kind of songbird, yeah.
Right. Into the shade or take advice from the lights. Be a child or be like a child.
Yeah.
You will want for nothing and you will never be heard.
Yeah.
Which is such a wonderful, unresolved ending that just leaves me. It really is arresting.
Thank you.
So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the ending then.
Well, I'm always afraid it comes, it's too close. I don't think it's sort of close in a problematic way, but it does come. I was reading from Louis Glück, who has a poem that ends, "So it was settled. I could have a childhood there, which came to mean being always alone." And I've been thinking for quite a long time about what it means to be a child and what it means to not be a child. Children are people whose contract with adults often is the adults will take care of your needs but won't necessarily care what you think or what you want. I hope that my partner and I are doing a better job of parenthood than that. But that is the basic contract of childhood, where you don't have to provide for yourself, but adults can believe that they know better than you do. And sometimes that's true. Adults know when it's your bedtime. But sometimes it's not. And it's quite frustrating to feel you're living that way when you're a child. And I think that's a poem about being an adult and living that way, thinking that you can't ever get what you want or can't articulate what you want or don't have the right to ask for what you want. No one would listen. No one would hear you. No one would understand. People would laugh at you. It would be either impossible or unethical for any adult to give you what you would like to fulfill your desire. On the other hand, you won't need things. This is a very, I think this is not, limited to trans people, but this is a trans book, right? Every poem that's worth rereading is about 5 or 10 or 15 things. But one of the easily articulated at this point things that poem is about is feeling that you can't find peers and feeling that you can't come out because no one would understand. And that you're sort of living in the film Casablanca, where you just kind of have to take one for the team, or that you're, worse yet, incomprehensible to others. And so your best option is to live as if you were a child, incomprehensible to the adults around you, but satisfied to have your needs taken care of. I no longer think I'm living that way. I've been very, very lucky with the people who've known me for a long time and with people who haven't, in terms of really feeling understood. I'm better now, as the corpse in Monty Python and the Holy Grail says. I really am much better now. And the fears that are in that poem and in parts of that book have not come true, and the hopes have.
Mm.
So, yay. But it is a poem about feeling that you're never going to be understood unless you speak from a position of authority that makes your desires inappropriate, or unless you speak from a position where you sort of give up in advance.
So, again, this isn't a question, but then I just want to point out that one of the other things that makes that ending so powerful and so unresolved is that in that sentence, if I'm understanding the way you're speaking about it now, it seems like you will want for nothing, but you will never be heard.
Right.
It's not a but. It's an and. You
it's
will
an
want
and.
For nothing and you will never be heard.
Well, the idea was to make the negativity of that last independent clause more of a surprise when
right.
it hits.
Right. And
I'm
that's...
glad you liked that little poem. I really that I came so close to just not putting that in the book because it's so sort of shapeless and fragmentary. But I'm glad it moves you.
It doesn't seem shapeless or fragmentary to me at all. It feels very aphoristic to me.
It is aphoristic. It's aphoristic like Callimachus, the ancient Greek poet I've been adapting and translating, who my next book of verse will consist entirely of imitations and adaptations of him. And then there's going to, after that, I hope, be a book that's more like advice that's just by me. But the brand new book
yes.
is a book about how to read poems that I did not write.
I think first and foremost, mm-hmm. You know, again, our listeners,
mm-hmm. our blessed listeners.
Hi, listeners.
will want to know about the title of this book, which is
yeah.
Don't Read Poetry.
Yeah.
And the subtitle is A Book About How to Read Poems.
Yes, it
which
is.
Which makes me think of having heard the poet W.S. Merwin interviewed by Paul Holdengraber, and he said, you know, he sort of admits to Merwin, I don't know how to read poetry. And
Ooh.
Merwin says, oh, that's your problem right there. You shouldn't don't read poetry. You need to read individual poems. You need to find poems, you know.
You know, if I had heard that interview, I probably couldn't have used my title because Merwin said it before I did. We have this idea that there is an entity called poetry and you either appreciate it or you don't. And that's nonsense. Poetry as a mass noun is a name for a very large body of objects that are acoustically and verbally interesting, made with this wide assortment of writerly or performative techniques. And reading poetry is like listening to music. You don't like music, you like certain kinds of music or certain artists or certain songs. And listening to music, learning to listen to music, is a matter of figuring out what experiences you want to have from different kinds of organized sound and then finding out how to get them and where to get them. And that may mean fairly challenging arrangements of sound, Ornette Coleman or Webern or somebody, or it may mean extremely sort of intuitive bite-size things. I don't know, Halsey. I love Halsey so much. If someone would wanted me to write about Halsey, I would do that so fast. But if somebody plays you some Webern and you don't like it, it doesn't mean you don't like music. It means you don't like short 20th century 12-tone piano compositions or whatever they played you, and vice versa. And discovering how many kinds of poems are out there and how many kinds of things poems can do for you is a similar process. The big difference being in 21st century America, there are many, many ways to find music, especially pop and pop-adjacent kinds of music and film scores. They're all around us. Poems, often we get them in school and we might get poems that are the wrong poems for us, and we might get unnecessarily limiting, not wrong, but just very limiting ideas of what a poem is or what a poem can do. And we say, well, I don't like that, so I don't like poetry, I don't understand poetry. And in fact, if you came across the right poems for you, it might be that there's some beauty and some enlightenment and some emotional rewards and just some joy that those poems can give you. And some of those poems are quite intellectually challenging, and some are not, and that's okay. But I want to help readers become aware of how much is out there and of some of the ways to hear and read some of what is out there. And the book, Don't Read Poetry, begins by sort of saying what I've just said. You know, there's a lot out there. Look for poems you like, and don't worry if you don't like others. And then there are six chapters, and each of the chapters is not so much one variety of poetry or one form or one poet or certainly not one historical period, but six things that poems can do for us. And you may only care about poems that do thing one, three, and five. Some people only care about poems if they do thing four. There exist poems that arguably do things one through six. Those poems are great and rare. knowing that there are multiple things some poems can do and not every poem that I like does all of those things can help you find poems that you care about. Sorry, too much?
No, that was perfect. That was wonderful. I was just sort of, it made me think about going back to what you were saying about, you know, the way that we typically come into interaction with poetry is mostly in school. And it's such a great metaphor to think about the way that we find music and especially young people. I mean, that like music is everything to many people, you know, they wouldn't be able to survive without it and make their way through their experiences without it. And that is, for those of us who have found poetry, that is what poetry is. And it feels really unfair to poetry because the way that we find it, because we find it in school. This is now the third interview of this season, and this is the third time I'm going back to this. My daughter's about to take the standardized test this next week. She's in the third grade. She's like losing sleep about it. It's ridiculous.
We had a third grader and a seventh grader. It's standardized testing week.
Yeah.
It's awful. Those things should not exist.
Right. And, you know, there's all these, around this time of year when they're doing these standardized tests, all these stories start popping up about, you know, there was like the poet Naomi Shihab Nye took one of the standardized tests that was had a personal essay of hers in it, and she couldn't answer the questions about. She didn't answer the questions correctly. You know, she didn't get the right answers. So anyway, I won't get onto my soapbox about it, but I wonder if you could speak a little bit, because this, in some way, this your book feels very like it's so generous and it's so smart at the same time, and it's also like not narrow in its vision of poetry. It's not only contemporary poetry, and I think that's really wonderful. It makes everything feel so inviting. You know, I was sort of reading it, thinking about people who in my own life who don't necessarily read poetry and how they might encounter this book. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about, to me, the book feels a little bit reparatory, you know?
Yeah, you're my ideal reader.
And I wonder if you could speak about like the way that we come into contact with poems in schools. And then when I think about my own kids and their teachers, like they don't hate poetry. They just don't know how to do it. And then they're also, you know, beholden to teaching poetry in this way where then students can answer multiple choice questions about it on a test. So could you just speak a little bit about that, about school and poetry and like, where do we go from here?
Yeah. So there's not one solution. The worst and most common problem of poetry in the schools is that people have to teach the test. They have to teach. Teachers feel that they have to teach people how to read in order to give right answers on a test. And that's not how the arts should work. The second biggest problem, I think, is many teachers, not all, but many teachers simply don't read a lot of poets or a lot of poems for fun. If they do read poems for fun, it might be a small group of poems that they themselves encountered in school or that reflect their generation or that reflect their particular experience. Or sometimes if they come from a writing background, it might be their friends' poems. And that's not enough. It's great, but it's not enough. Third problem is even when you get teachers who are enthusiastic about the techniques of making verse and the techniques of making poems and want to help students see the arts and poetry in particular as living, breathing, growing, changing things that you can be part of and not just a passive question answering audience member for when you're 8 or 12 or 16 or 18. Even teachers who have a fundamentally sort of creative divergent opening things up approach to the art of poetry often teach it as creative writing first, where you make your own thing and it doesn't matter what other people's things you read, or teach it as exclusively contemporary. And that's unfortunate because the past has a lot of resources and there are a lot of writers from the past who could mean a lot to many of us if we were just able to acclimate ourselves to some of their these and thous or to some of their assumptions. So I would like to see teachers who are able to connect students' own creative writing and students' own creativity to the work that the students didn't write and to a wide variety of that work so students can find what's meaningful to them, including work by people who have been dead for a long time as well as people who are alive right now, and work by people with a variety of identities, including national origin and ethnic identification, so that Asian American students are getting Latinx and white and African American and, you know, South African poets, and Singaporean students are getting American poets and Irish poets and so on. So I'd like to see the kind of diversity in the classroom of time as well as style and identity. And I'd like to see the critical creative connection being made in classrooms. And I'd like to see teachers teach poems that they enjoy reading. I do not teach poems I dislike. I've read enough poems to be able to construct syllabi composed only of poems I like, so I guess I'm lucky. But if you don't really like it, maybe your time's not well spent on it. That's one of the things that distinguishes an arts class from a history class, right? Nobody really – what's a good example that's not super triggering? Nobody really likes the Teapot Dome scandal, but it happened. It's part of American government, and you have to teach it if you're teaching American history, I think. Or, you know, Watergate. Nobody's like a huge fan of Watergate, I hope. But if you're teaching an arts class and you don't like this poem, you should be able to substitute that poem. And of course, teachers can't because tests. But teachers should, and teachers should know a wide variety of work. And it should be easy to find that wide variety. And the good news is it's easier than ever because of the internet. And our students, once they get interested, sometimes take the initiative in terms of finding a variety of contemporary work, which is great. But they do need some help finding poems by people who aren't like them and by people who've been dead for a while. Not because it's special sacred heritage, but because it's just a wider array of things that can be meaningful, things that are beautiful to a lot of us once we have some experience with it. And teachers also, I think, have too much placed on them in terms of exposing people to poetry or connecting people to poetic techniques and various poets and poems in a school setting, because much American culture, many parts of American culture, don't have a lot of verse compositions in them and don't have a lot of poems in them outside of school. And there's no existential reason for that. There are cultures in the world. I think Ireland is a sort of standard example. And in certain ways, because hip-hop composition is verse composition, if you grow up surrounded by hip-hop, that's another example. There are certain cultural matrices where if you grow up in that matrix, you've got some kind of verse composition and some kind of history of one kind of poem around you all the time. And so you don't expect it to come only from schools. But if that's not your background, then you might expect to learn everything you know about poets, poems, and poetry only through educational institutions that have to prepare you to be evaluated by teachers. And that's kind of annoying. Composed music people, quote, classical, close quote, music people, have similar and maybe more severe problems, whereas pop music people and comic book people, and I'm certainly a comic book person, have the opposite problem. This is an art form that's not taken seriously enough by institutions, but it's an art form that people who want it encounter outside those institutions. So there's not generally a lot of worry about, oh, I'm not terribly good at Batman. I only got a B in Batman. I'm not a real Batman fan. My Batman teacher didn't think I was great at Batman. And that's good. It means if you're really into Batman, which some of my friends are, you can go out and find people who want to talk to you about why it's great that there's a Batwoman ongoing, or, you know, what's the right way to portray the Joker. And you won't be tested on it. Or if you are tested on it, it'll just be by snobby fans. It won't be by people who determine whether you're going to law school. Mm-hmm. And I would like Batman to get some of the respect that Paradise Lost gets. Mm-hmm. But I'd also like Paradise Lost to be treated more like Batman, where you can just encounter it and be a fan of it outside outside class. Mm-hmm. And I'm using Batman as a good example, partly because I'm not actually a Batman person. You can have me back and we can talk about X-Men, and that will go on for an hour.
You know what I was going to say, because I've recently, you know, entered into this other world of writing YA fiction.
Did I know that?
I just published my first YA novel.
Oh, wow.
And I feel like you could substitute YA for Batman in that entire argument. You know, it's something that is not taken seriously in academia.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm trying to be very much in the YA world right now, and it's really niche. I'm trying to learn as much specifically queer YA as possible,
and
it's giving me
some great. I could off air. Well, I'll give you some.
Yeah, well, I've written about it a little.
Oh, okay.
I've written about it a little.
Yeah.
But I'm still learning. There's so much. But yeah, the YA world and the way that the YA world has constructed an intensely political way of talking about what's good and what's bad and what's moving and what's effective and what's problematic is just light years off and ahead of the way that adult literary fiction talks about itself, right? How many adult literary realist fiction works have you read where if they'd only used a sensitivity reader, it would be a better book and people wouldn't be throwing rocks at them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sensitivity readers are so far only a thing in YA and in the science fiction and fantasy community as far as I can tell.
Right.
Is right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And no, the YA world is, you know, is not a perfect space, but I really love being on the fringes of that and investigating it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really I've found to be so clear, especially coming from the world of poetry into the world of YA, is that it's like also just looked upon. It's a really clear demonstration of misogyny in action, because it's the I think the reason why it is looked down upon is because those are books for girls, you know? They're books for young women mostly. And I feel like that's probably right up there with reasons why it's not taken seriously in academia.
I think that's right. At the same time, the poetry world is in an anomalous position here because historically, the kind of poetry that has been celebrated academically and supported by prizes and regarded as the best that has been said and thought in the world has mostly been by dudes. But the contemporary poetry world and the way that a room looks when you're teaching a poetry class, especially at the undergraduate level, those are almost always majority female rooms, at least when I've done readings and when I've taught. Sometimes it's 55% women and girls. And, you know, maybe 5%, 7% non-binary people and the rest is dudes. Sometimes it's more like 70%. But contemporary poetry is something that is often mostly women, but historically it hasn't been, and it's retained some of the prestige that comes with Oxford, Cambridge, common room cigars. And YA has never had that because it emerges from writing for younger kids and the education of younger kids, which has historically been the province of women. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
It might be wrong. Like, it might be historically wrong. That's my sense of these two worlds. But I wasn't reading YA when I was a teen. It wasn't being addressed to me. I mean, people didn't know I was a girl, so they gave me boys' books. And
right.
I said, no, thank you. I would rather read about mutants and spaceships, which I still do, of course.
Rather than The Hatchet.
And Celtic Gods. What?
That book, The Hatchet. That's
like
the one YA book for boys. My daughter is reading that right now, and she just, like, seriously can't wrap her mind around.
Of course.
Like,
third grade is – it's like a middle grade book, isn't it? There's – the world has changed, and it hasn't changed enough.
Yeah. Yes. That is very true.
Yeah. I have to get your novel. I know your poetry. I didn't know there was a YA novel. I'm terrible.
No, I mean it's a totally different world.
Okay.
So
I'll send you the one. There's one I wrote an introduction to that's really exciting to me. I'll send that to you.
What is it called?
Oh, so this is a novel that's quite important to me. It is called Being Emily, and it came out in 2013, and it's not the first trans YA book. But it is the first – it's apparently the first YA book that's got a trans girl as the narrator, as the protagonist, rather than, oh, no, you know, my sister's trans. What do I do?
Mm.
And it has a certain kind of instructional aspect to it. It's one of those YA novels that is built in order to convey a whole lot of information. Which in 2013 was even more important than it is in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And as you would expect, people who knew about this novel when I was in the process of coming out as an adult got me in touch with it, and I ended up meeting the author. And it's really good. And I ended up being able to write an introduction to the second edition. It's an indie publisher, Bella Books, and the second edition came out in 2018. And it's really exciting. And the author has gone on to, I think there are 5 more novels. There's a new novel that's about non-binary teen identity and race and learning to be a white ally that's out right, that's actually has the same pub date as Don't Read Poetry.
Mm.
So it's exciting.
Well,
that novel is called In the Silences, if you want to look it up.
In the Silences,
it's really good.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. Have you read the book, If I Was Your Girl?
Oh, yeah, Meredith Russo.
Yeah.
That is an interesting book.
Yeah.
And Meredith Russo has said that she wouldn't write it that way if she had to write it now.
That's interesting. You know, that I know it very well because my editor of my YA novel edited that book as well.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's moving. It's well-constructed.
Yeah.
It is so careful. And Meredith Russo has said this. It's so careful to make the trans girl in that book as normal as possible. And when I read it, I could see the gears turning in terms of how normal that girl had to be. And I want Meredith Russo to write another book that is really strange, where the fandom is not Star Wars fandom, it's some niche anime thing that her readers might be more into. And the social lives of the teens involved are much stranger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very Southern, too. I mean, the girls in the book are portrayed as being very, you know.
Yeah.
They're so friendly. I was like, what's going to happen with these – like the group of girls that she falls in with are so friendly. I was really like, are they going to be a cult and they're going to kill her or something? You know, like,
That would be Laura Koschisky novel.
Oh,
and I was
going to
read you Laura Koschisky. So good. I was going to read you a Laura Koschisky poem.
Okay. We just have to fangirl for a minute over Laura Koschisky because
yes,
I know that you're a fan of hers.
Yes,
she
yes.
is one of the first poets. When I was like 19 years old and I was just learning to read poems, she was one of the first poets I ever read. We read her second book, Housekeeping in a Dream, in my first poetry workshop. And I went back and read her first book, and it was right before Suspicious River came out, and I read that novel. I loved it so much. I'm just like, I'm a super fan of hers, and her poems are very deeply ingrained in my own experience of learning how to read poetry, and it's like from the beginning to the end, you know, from the beginning until now.
Yes,
so
yes!
You have spoken so beautifully about her work, and you have elevated it in a way that I found, it's like fist pump kind of stuff.
Yes.
I'm like so with you on Laura Koschisky.
I love that you were with her that early. I discovered her work because Fire and Flower was in the stack of like 100 books that had been sent to the Yale Review in the late 90s, which no one was reading. And at the time, I was still in New Haven a lot, and I just hung out at the Yale Review office and just sort of zoomed through the stacks of unsolicited poetry books hoping to find something I liked. And I read Fire and Flower, and then I read it again, and then I read it again, and then I read it again, and I thought, this is what I want to do with my life.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's funny because that is her newborn book, and I wasn't going to be a mom for, several years yet, but I was already someone who was thinking a lot about parents and children.
Yes. I love those books. Wasn't there another? She published two books. She writes so much. She's such a prolific writer. I think she published another book right at the same time. Another book of poems. I can't remember what.
No, that's later. Okay. Fire and Flower comes out, and then the next publication, there's two books of poems at once.
Okay.
One of which is Gardening in the Dark.
Yes.
And then there's a book that is the poems are in alphabetical order.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like it was written earlier that comes out at the same time. What It Wasn't. That's what that book is called. What It Wasn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I love her novels as well. I think she's just such a she's just has a mind that I would follow anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And her novels are in different genres. She really tries to do something different each time. And the best ones mean so much to me, including like Boy Heaven, which is like her first YA novel.
I haven't read that.
It's so much fun. It's a perfectly constructed novel.
I'm writing it down.
Yeah.
What's it called? Boy Heaven?
Boy Heaven, that's yeah. And right. There's scenes that are in Boy Heaven that are in her poems. Yeah. You will see this happen if you read all of Laura Koscielski, which you may have done. Have you had her on your show? Have you written about her Selected? Because there was that Selected that came out last year.
Oh, no. I should definitely have her on my show.
Copper Canyon did a Selected last year. It's really exciting.
Oh, and that's funny, because she hasn't really been a Copper Canyon poet, has she?
No, but she was with Au Sable and UMass and other places that either they're contest winners or you don't necessarily stay with them.
Okay. I'm going to have her on my show. I can't believe that I haven't thought to do that. I've even seen her since I've started this podcast.
Yes. And, yes. Graham the engineer is standing in the doorway and I don't know why.
You got to go.
I'm afraid.
Oh, no. I'm supposed to read a poem or two by someone.
Can you read one poem?
Can I read
two? Do you
have
enough time?
Yeah. I mean, that's up to Graham. I brought four different ones that you could read that I didn't write if you want.
Let me see if you can grab me 5 minutes.
Okay. Graham's going to look for 5 minutes here.
Okay.
So this is a poem I've just come across by a new British poet who identifies as English and Indonesian. His name is Will Harris. And I do not play video games, but my friends do. And I've been thinking about what being part of a video gaming generation does to your sense of yourself visually, ethnically, psychologically, emotionally. Halo 2 by Will Harris. There were those walls where brochure-like paintings of a young Christ showed his hairless body pricked with blood aglow. The artist, by a fine excess, had meant to advertise his suffering. Late one night, playing Halo 2, I saw myself in what I saw on screen, and from Beaver Creek to Uplift shot anything that moved. The birds singing in the artificial trees, the true self, nothing more than the self as seen.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This poem is by Laura Koscielski. Hardware store in a town without men. I found myself in a story without suspense, only one deaf falcon circling deftly, and that wild college girl next door screaming at her mother on the phone. My heart, a golden lobster, a star in a grave, some hot blood running underground, and all my early daydreams loosed like termites in the walls of some deserted church. Oh, I recognized my agony right away. The howling dog of daylight life. The years of lust had opened up a permanent inn for phantoms in my brain. Then I turned 40. Every morning, sweeping out the shadows from the cobwebbed corners, raking the leaves from the gutters, the hair from the drains, and sleep, the sweet rolling water of its ease, a stroll through the beautiful ruins of my own dreams, a hardware store in a town without men, whole shelves devoted to wrenches gleaming, and no reason to lock the door. No door.
Oh, God. Okay. The howling dog of daylight life. She's just an amazing poet.
Two more poems, sonnet size. Yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Another new one. This is from Terrence Hayes's new book, American Sonnets from a Past and Future Assassin, which for me is certainly the most important and the best book of poetry published in 2018 when there were many, many other good books. American Sonnet from a Past and Future Assassin by Terrence Hayes. Because he cannot distinguish a blackbird from a crow or raven, it's all the more brazen when the autocrat kisses a cat. Because he's a kettle of oil about to boil, it's all the more touching when the despot pets a pet. The skin breaks so easily, he says, but he cries it softly. Because he's someone who can't distinguish a horse from a zebra without the stripes, he can't describe himself without looking in a mirror. Baller. Baller. Dentures, makeup, he's almost too flaky to be the villain because he's someone who cannot distinguish meat from malarkey. Anything close to his mouth gets bitten. It's one of the lighter, fluffier poems in that quite vitriolic and wonderful and energetic book.
Yes.
Some of the best poems in that book cannot be read on the radio.
Yeah.
So last one I'm going to read you, it comes from several hundred years ago. It is a poem by the wonderful and entertaining poet Robert Herrick, H-E-R-R-I-C-K. And it is a poem about all the other poems in his major book. The Argument of His Book by Robert Herrick. I sing of brooks, of blossoms, birds, and bowers, of April, May, of June, and July flowers. I sing of maypoles, hot carts, wassails, those are beer parties, wakes, of bridegrooms, brides, and of their bridal cakes. I read of youth, of love, and have access by these to sing of cleanly wantonness. I sing of dews, of rains, and piece by piece of balm, of oil, of spice, and ambergris. I sing of times trans-shifting, and I write how roses first came red and lilies white. I write of groves, of twilights, and I sing the court of Mab and of the fairy king. I write of hell. I sing and ever shall of heaven and hope to have it after all.
I feel like I should have every poet bring in four poems rather than one. That was so wonderful to hear all four of those. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's so much fun to it feels very flattering but also weird to talk about my own work. Saying, here's a poem I love. Let me read it to you. I didn't write it. I love it so much. If there's time, I can talk about why I love it, but let me just read it to you. That's one of my favorite things to do and one of the reasons to love radio as a medium.
And that's exactly why I ask that question. It's one of my favorite things, too. There's nothing better than hearing a poet read, you know, what is, like, you know, their favorite poem and talk about it. It's just great.
Thank you.
You can find Stephanie Burt's poem, Advice from the Lights, in her collection, Advice from the Lights, out from Grey Wolf Press in 2017. You can also find her book, Don't Read Poetry, a book about how to read poems, out now from Basic Books. This is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.